Thank you ever so much, Kathy. And it is such a pleasure to be with you. And I'll make one tiny correction. I'm currently at home on Boonwurrung land. So I'd like to take this brief opportunity to thank them for their care of this country for over 50,000 years. And I think about that when I walk around my neighbourhood, as I get to do a lot more of these days now that we're locked down. And it is such a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk at length to Peter Drew and to share that conversation with you. Peter, welcome, and thanks for joining us from semi-lockdown Adelaide.
Thanks for having me. It's the news has just come in yesterday, so I don't really know what the situation is, but I think we'll be all right.
Yeah, you'll be all right. We managed, you'll manage. Now, the book that that we'll spend a bit of time talking about today, which is parts of road movie, part memoir, part theorizing, part therapy. It's got a lot going on, and I think my best mental image for your book is that it's like a beautiful MRI of your brain, where we can see the different parts of your neural activity sort of lighting up as we bounce around the experience. But it's also a phenomenal, I think, insight into the links between advocacy and politics and art and how one can influence the other. And I think that's a really powerful story for us to explore further. But there are three things that I really want to thank you for, Peter. One, as Kathy said, your work on our streets. Our world and certainly our nation's conversation is all the better for having your posters in it. The second thing I'd like to thank you for is the book, which I think, once again, is very challenging and very moving and very provocative in terms of turning some of your observations on our own lives and making sure that we test ourselves in really important ways. And its fierce honesty, I think, is a real contribution to the broader discussion that we need to have. And the third thing that I really want to thank you for is reminding me of the word munted. I hadn't thought about the word munted for a very long time, and then it pops up in your book, and you're talking about basically things that are stuffed. So, for the benefit of all our broad audience at the conference today, can you just describe or explain what you mean by munted?
It's so funny. I was going to make some comment about, I mean, all of my posters are, well, most of them are about digging up old things and finding a new use for them. And munted is a word that means something is completely stuffed, to the point of it being absurd. So I can't remember what I described as being munted in the book. Can you remember?
I was just flicking through desperately. I know I've got it marked, but I can't actually find the page. So, in true confession, I can't actually give you it, but I'll write it to you later where it appears, what page it's on. And for those enjoying this conversation, watch out for the word munted. It's very special. And I think it's particularly powerful and useful in this respect because you're actually talking through the book in terms of the political dimensions and challenges that you address about things that so many people would regard as just being beyond us. And I think, that determination that not everything is munted and it's really worth trying to engage and to find a meaningful way to express that is a really important contribution that you make. So I suppose the sort of theme that I thought we might explore today is that combination of what seems to be stuffed and how we can respond, which really is all about putting communities in control. But tell me about posters. Why posters? I mean, you trained as an artist, you've been overseas and done study overseas, and you could be in galleries, you could be in, private collections, but you choose to be literally wandering the nation's streets and highways and byways with a pot of flower glue and a rolled up, bundle of posters. Why this?
Well, that's a question I keep asking myself, and that's what the book's really about, is because I got so wrapped up in the projects that I never really stopped to think, why have I found myself in this weird position of traveling around the country, sticking up thousands of posters? And because it was never really something that I envisaged and then sort of built towards. In a way it was, but I really just started doing it and found that it was something that really gave me a sense of purpose, and I've kept going. But I started making posters while I was in art school in Scotland. And it was really because I was out of frustration in a lot of ways, because art school was very much about teaching us to do research, which was very handy for me later on. But it was all very conceptually based practice. And it was really geared towards making art for the art world and talking in a way which was very theoretical and esoteric and for a very small audience. And I've never really liked that about art. I to me, the art that I like the best speaks to me in a very intuitive way. And I like that ability of art to sort of cut through theory and be able to speak to a large amount of people. And posters, that's posters are all about that. A good poster needs to be able to be read to begin with. And I was living in Scotland, and I thought, I want to try out posters. I'd made street art before then, but it wasn't sort of the poster form. So I made a poster that said, it was in the form of a 18th century street poster. It had sort of old text and a picture of a ship that I took from a painting of the First Fleet coming to Australia. And it was during the election while I made this poster, because both major parties were promising to stop the boats. And that phrase, stop the boats, was just particularly absurd to me coming from a nation of immigrants. And so I made this poster that said, Australia says stop the boats to avoid Aboriginal genocide, stop Great Britain's illegal migration to Australia. And it, because it looked like it was made 200 years ago, I think people understood what it was about. And I went down to London and stuck them up on the street and very quickly got a very sort of immediate response. And it was only then that I thought maybe posters could be something that I could make more of. And I mean, I looking back, there are things that I like about that poster. There are things that I really don't like about it. And that's sort of what I try to do with every project, is figure out what worked and figure out what I don't like about it so that I can try to make it better the next time.
I think it's a great poster, and I'm sure there's another discussion to be had in what you didn't like about it. But let's talk about, you know, the sort of the development of that concept and I suppose what's common to the process of determining, you know, what's the idea you want to focus on, and then, as you pointed out, you know, research, which was the gift of art school in one respect, and then the determination, I suppose, of how that comes together. And the poster I have in mind is Monga Khan and his friends, and very conveniently, he is immediately behind you in your workspace. Mm. So we have an impression of the fabulous Monga Khan, who is such an extraordinarily splendid figure. But tell us about how that idea came together. I mean, Stop the Boats was a response to a political action and to an election debate and to, you know, an absurd three-word slogan. What drew you to Monga and his confrere, and what were you hoping that people would take away from it?
Well, it was after I had done the Real Australian Say Welcome project, and that was sort of very successful, and I thought I wanted to follow it up with something a little deeper that explored Australia's history of immigration, and especially the White Australia policy. And I'd heard that there are these photographs in the Australian National Archive of people who had applied for exemptions to the dictation test. And the dictation test was a function of the White Australia policy. So Monga Khan and thousands of other people like him were already living in Australia, and because they couldn't just be kicked out, the government created this system of exemptions whereby you could apply for an exemption and therefore you could leave Australia and come back without fear of being racially excluded. And so because of this racist policy, we now have this amazing photographic record of just how diverse Australia was at the time. And that's what those sort of ironies of history are what you really look for as an artist, try to sort of make art out of research. And so I've got up on screen the original photograph of Monga Khan that I turned into the poster. And I knew as soon as I saw this photograph that this was the guy to be the hero image, essentially, of that project, because he not only does he look proud and regal, he has such a... He looks sort of self-possessed in a way which is strong. And he has a strength that you admire and would want to identify with. And that was really the sort of the core insight of that project, is that I think people today would rather identify with the struggle of people like Monga Khan than they would identify with the Australians who wrote the White Australia policy. To me, his struggle and his story is far more Aussie than the people who created the White Australia policy. And there are some things that I can point out about this image. You can see, for example, that he's actually sitting in a chair and he's leaning back a bit. For the poster, I did sort of make him a little more upright and standing, just to give it more presence in some way. So there are little tiny adjustments like that, but really I wanted to do as much as I could to preserve the archival qualities of the image, so that when you saw it on the street, you thought straight away, well, who's that? But also I can tell that image was taken maybe 100 years ago. And there are just qualities to photographs like this that convey that very quickly without you really realizing it. And so I found this image and chose another 11 from the archive, added the word Aussie and stuck up 1,000 of them around the country. And I really haven't stopped, which is an odd thing. I thought it would be a project for that year. And after that, I'd do something else. But I've sort of come to realize that I think this project is going to be part of my life for the foreseeable future, because there are so many photographs in the archives that I can keep sort of going back and finding more people, more stories. And there is just something that I don't think is ever going to be, it's always going to have relevance, that tension between race and nation. And I think it's the job of culture to sort of help negotiate that tension. I don't think it can ever be solved in a sense, but it's the job of art and culture to help sort of to soothe that conflict. And that's what I hope I can do.
Soothe, but also provoke. I mean, there's no question that your work is intended to push people to think about, you know, their own response to the images and to the words, and in combination. I mean, and I suppose before we move to the provocation bit, you know, that process of stripping it absolutely down. You've got one image and one word, and I think, you know, the power of that simplicity is really extraordinary. Is that hard to do? Do you have to work for a long period of time to get it to that level of concision?
Yeah, it takes a while, because when I started looking at the archive, there is so much detail in there that you really have to, your mind is going all over the place in terms of what you could do with those materials. And your first impulse as a good artist, rather than a propagandist, which is the sort of the form which I play with, as a good artist, you want to tell as much nuance as possible. You want to really convey who these people were, not just as sort of singular identities, but as real people with all kinds of details to their lives. And but in order to create effective propaganda, the job is to really eliminate all those nuances so that you see an image and a message which is absolutely immediate and but also in some way false. And so what I really try to do is draw people's attention to that process so that, and it's sort of a game of first you have to get the audience hooked on something which is very simple and clear but not the full story, but then you can introduce more materials that show that there is actually more to these people's lives than just image Aussie. But you sort of got to have the simple message up front that creates the sort of the pointy end of the wedge, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So you've got to hook them in, which, but I'm interested also in the distinction you draw between art and propaganda. I mean, I think you said to me last week that that you do art disguised as propaganda. How would you define the difference?
Well, I think one of the easiest ways to define the difference is that propaganda is made by typically nations, or you could say that advertising is a form of propaganda also, but it usually has some force behind it, some authority, whereas my posters are made by me. I have the sanction of nobody, and I've been quite deliberate in that that method, that I'm not affiliated to any political party or anyone. What I do is completely illegal. And so I don't really have any, there's no sort of enforcement behind what I'm doing. It's merely a suggestion that these people are Aussie. But another way to look at propaganda is that it is certain of itself, in that it is saying, this is the way things are. This is the way the world is, or this is the way the world should be, or this is the thing that we need to eliminate in the world. That's very different to art. That is all about asking questions and presenting something which is so, you know, I mean, good art should be full of questions and full of ambiguity and nuance, all that sort of detail that we see in the real world, whereas propaganda is about eliminating those details and making something sort of clear and strong, but also false. And so ultimately, if I can draw attention to that process so people can be better at recognizing propaganda, basically.
It's an education. So tell us, though, about the reaction you get, because, I mean, I'm sure most of us probably looking at those posters and thinking, you know, with great pride that there is this, you know, extensive history of diversity in our nation, as appalling as the treatment was at very many points in time and continues to be. But what are the reactions you get on the street as you're there sort of posting this stuff up in hard to get to spots? how do people deal? Do you get lots of negative reaction? I mean, that's a particularly impressive shot. How did you get up there?
Well, there's always a way. I mean, that's one of the things I'd probably like to talk about, is that in so many ways, the reasons behind what I do, I mean, I care about the issues, but there's a part of me which really loves the adventure, the excitement of putting up posters in public space. And there is something inherently aggressive about that, mm-hmm. I guess. And my temperament in general, I'm not really a typical progressive in a lot of ways, because I do like that. There's something egoistic about what I do also. It's about the conquest of space in a lot of ways. I just think that I've found a way of sublimating that desire, which is hopefully helpful to other people as well. But I just recognize that in myself, in my temperament, that I really like going out into the city and go and get and figuring out how can I get up there, and no one's going to tell me that I can't. But anyway, I digress. The the reactions I get, well, I wear high vis, so I get ignored by the vast majority of people on the street. And it's kind of, it's really surprising what you can be doing wearing high vis and people just completely ignore you. But every now and then I do get confronted by somebody, and it's not as bad as it used to be. Back in 2016, when I started sticking up the Monga Khan posters and all the other Aussie series, I did get hassled a lot more. And I think that there was this wave of xenophobia going through the country at that time, which was worse than I had ever seen. And I've definitely noticed that it has calmed down on the street. That was when Reclaim Australia and these other groups were having marches. And so, yeah, I'd get confronted by people and it would range from, oh, that guy's not Aussie. And then I could have a discussion with that person about the history and how I see them as being, you know, more Aussie than the people that attempted to exclude them. But sometimes I do run into people that just want to get aggressive and they don't want to negotiate. Basically, they are looking for a fight, but it rarely happens. And whenever someone asks me this question about what it's like out on the street, I always try to emphasize the people who are just a bit fearful, and through conversation you can sort of walk them towards a sort of peaceful center. And that's the vast majority of confrontations I have. And I don't really fault those people, because I just think fearing the other is actually a part of human nature. It's something that we all experience. And it's just really how we respond to that fear that defines us.
And the aggression is fear too, don't you think?
No, absolutely. It's just a response to fear. I see it as a weakness. I don't sort of fall into the trap of seeing racist, bigoted people as being, I don't think it's a form of strength. That's why I was so adamant to make Monga Khan, to pick an image, a hero image that was strong, because I guess it comes to a different tactic that it's not one that I, it's a tactic that I sort of avoid, is the appeal to compassion. Because if you are talking to somebody who's afraid and your appeal to them is for them to be more compassionate, I just don't think that really works, telling someone who's afraid to be compassionate, because it actually makes them more afraid in some sense. But if you appeal to their strength, to their courage, there's something that's a better way of sort of unlocking that fear, I think. And that's sort of the tactic that's underneath some of my posters, I think.
So you appeal to the aspects of themselves that they would regard positively, and try and tap in through that. Is that a fair?
No, absolutely.
Summary?
That's another. That's a really good way of putting it. I just, it's a hard thing to understand, but I just think progressive people are temperamentally more compassionate than conservatives in a lot of ways. And I don't mean that to sound like a slur against conservatives. I sort of think the populace is an ecosystem, and there are, on one end of the spectrum, there are some very conservative people that have just very low levels of compassion, and that's fine. And on the other end, there are people who just find it very easy to be compassionate to the other. And There's no good really sort of trying to demand that the people on the other end of the spectrum be like you. I think you just have to be a little more savvy about it, basically, and try to understand their psychology enough to create reasons for them to be to sort of come to the middle.
And you spend a lot of time investigating, you know, or getting inside, or trying to the mindsets of people who disagree with you in various different ways. And your art is an effort to do that too, I think, is to try and come at it from a way that that will evoke, you know, conversation rather than ongoing conflict. And you know, whether or not that's conscious on your part, it's a really powerful dimension to to the product. But just before we take questions, and you know, there's so much in what you've just said that I'd love
already,
to.
Already, I didn't realize it just goes so quickly.
Yes, it does. So we'll hold off the questions, Kathy, for just a minute or two. But I just wanted to talk about that notion of really investigating your own motivations, because you've touched on that in a couple of your responses, and how important it is to really know what it is you're trying to do and to recognize, you know, your own fear and need in any particular process. And I think that's a really important conversation that people, particularly those of us who see ourselves as trying to support and assist others, really getting to grips with why you're doing that and what you're getting out of it is actually critical. And you've done a lot of that.
No, absolutely. I think I owed that to the people that had followed the project in a way, and myself, because as I said before, I really didn't know why I had become this guy that travels around sticking up posters. If I was honest, I really didn't have a good answer to that. And I, in writing the book, I took the time to think about how I'd gotten there. And a lot of it had to do with my family and my upbringing and unresolved things in that area of my life. And I came to realize that I had, and I think a lot of people do, I'd gotten into politics for basically therapeutic reasons. And you know, it takes many different things to satisfy a human being. We have political needs, we have social needs, emotional needs, and there's sort of what could be described as a spiritual element to that as well. And when people get into politics for reasons that should perhaps be satisfied elsewhere in their lives, I think it can be helpful, but if they do it with a complete lack of awareness, as I perhaps was doing, it leads to sort of unsatisfactory outcomes. I know that's very vague in some sense, but basically, there was something unsatisfying in me that I was trying to get out of putting up posters all over the country. And whilst I think some of the results of that were very good, if I'd kept going in the way that I was, it wasn't going to be sort of healthy for me in the long run. And I think that's true for a lot of young activists in some sense, that they have a idea of fixing the world because they are fundamentally, they haven't reconciled their own imperfectibility. I think that's sort of a hard task. It's no wonder really that people shy away from their own faults in order to, and do that by, you know, trying to fix the world. But yeah, that's essentially what the book is about.
It is, and for all that, and you know, the whole experience of traveling the nation to put up posters, the physicality of that, the energy that takes, and the evocation of youth hostels across the country, and cooking up pots of glue the night before, it's an incredible read. We'll take some questions from the floor, but and look forward to your thoughts on that. But you've just put up, Peter, your COVID poster, which for those people who perhaps like me are got teeny tiny screens, it says, together soon enough.
Soon enough, that's right.
On you go.
I can talk to it if you like.
Yeah, please.
I had planned to stick these up myself, but I couldn't, obviously, because of lockdown. And so for the first time, I sent them to people who volunteered to stick them up themselves. And it was really fun just to sort of let go, because the poster projects were something that I have always had a lot of control over, and to see the happiness that people, especially kids, have in sticking up posters themselves, it was just very satisfying. And I've realized that this is a great way to sort of empower people to do it themselves, because I get a lot of joy out of going out into public space and expressing myself. And I think posters are a great way for anyone to do that, because they're very gentle in a way. I mean, if you put them on hopefully an ugly wall and make the wall look better, generally it's community building rather than being destructive to the community. So this has taken up most of my 2020, and it's been a lot of fun.